Hello, and welcome to This Week I Learned, your audio guide to the most surprising discoveries and fascinating studies of the week. I'm your host, Lauren Hansen. This week I learned that in 1967, at the height of the Cold War, a massive solar storm was a huge threat to our national security. A new paper details the events that unfolded during the month of May 1967 that entangled America's burgeoning solar forecast center, the U.S. Air Force, President Johnson, and the Soviet Union. Basically, we were this close to starting a nuclear war with our Soviet enemies. Yep, we might be living in a very different world had the U.S. not started keeping an eye on the sun's activities. Scientists and the U.S. military began to realize that the sun and sun storms could have huge impacts on our technological systems down on Earth. So the government invested early on in solar and geomagnetic storm observations and forecasting. In the late 1950s, the U.S. military began monitoring solar activity and space weather, which are basically disturbances in the Earth's magnetic field and upper atmosphere. In the 1960s, a new branch of the Air Force's Air Weather Service routinely monitored the sun for solar flares. Now, solar flares are brief eruptions of radiation from the sun's atmosphere that can have a domino effect. They lead to electromagnetic disturbances on Earth, which can disrupt radio communication and power line transmissions and many other things. Now, it's no easy thing to just monitor the sun, so the Air Weather Service basically had a network of aerospace scientists all over North America, and by 1967, they were sending daily reports and forecasts. According to those reports, an unusually large group of sunspots with intense magnetic fields appeared in one region of the sun on May 18, 1967. By May 23rd, these reports were forecasting major flares and significant electromagnetic disturbances that were set to happen between 36 and 48 hours. In some reports, scientists said they could see solar flares with the naked eye. Other reports detailed unprecedented levels of radio waves. Meanwhile, in three locations across the Northern Hemisphere, the U.S. government had radars designed to detect incoming Soviet missiles. These sites were called ballistic missile early warning systems, and suddenly, on May 23, 1967, all three sites were jammed. And technically, any disruption in the radar's capabilities was considered an act of war. Now, because it was the Cold War, the Air Force was on high alert already, and was actually already flying aircrafts with nuclear weapons. So, on May 23rd, when commanders got word of the jammed missile systems, those additional air forces were put on ready-to-launch status. It was a crazy, grave situation, but luckily, the information from that network of aeroscientists, the reports of the sun's massive flare, well, they made it up the chain, possibly even to President Johnson, and the military correctly diagnosed the problem, and the offensive was called off. That geomagnetic storm that jammed the missile radars went on to disrupt U.S. radio communication for up to a week, but luckily, that was the worst of the fallout. This week I learned the real-life horror story of how a jewel wasp feeds her offspring. So the jewel wasp, so-called for its electric green-blue coloring, has specially tailored venom that has the power to hijack the brains of other insects, turning them into zombies. The cockroach is the female jewel wasp prey of choice, and how she captures it is that she comes from above. She swoops down, grabs the roach in her mouth, and swiftly injects the first round of venom into the thorax. And this temporarily paralyzes the cockroach so she can get down to more serious business. And that second sting is viciously exacting. It aims for two targets inside the insect's brain. Now, the wasp stinger is actually able to feel around inside the brain to find exactly what it needs. You see, the insect brain, like the human brain, is made up of neurons, and the wasp's venom is neurotoxic, so it can turn off or manipulate those neurons. So once she gets that second sting, it's believed the venom releases a flood of dopamine. Now in our brains, dopamine can have the effect of euphoria, as it's a part of the reward system of the brain. Though we don't know if dopamine has the same euphoric effect on cockroaches, scientists do know that this chemical surge causes this kind of bizarre behavior. The cockroach goes into a fit of grooming. There are many different theories, but the most interesting one is that this venom-caused behavior ensures that the cockroach is clean and fungus-free for that vulnerable baby wasp. So while the cockroach is busy cleaning itself, the mama wasp flies off to find the cockroach's tomb. So the cockroach is going to be acting as a combination meal and vessel for her larva to hatch. So she needs to find a safe, dark burrow to leave it in. While she's preparing this cozy deathbed, the zombie venom is working its way through the cockroach. Now that first paralyzing sting has worn off by this point, and yet the cockroach doesn't flee. That's because the venom mutates the roach's fear and flee neurons, so they're less active and less responsive. Now the wasp may be gone for about 30 minutes or so, and when she returns, the cockroach is basically under her spell. So first, she breaks off one of the cockroach's antennae and drinks its blood to replenish her energy. Then she takes hold of the stub of the antenna that she just mutilated and leads the insect into the death den. There, she attaches one of her eggs to the cockroach's leg and seals her offspring and the roach inside. Now, the cockroach is still alive, basically just waiting for the larva to hatch and to eat it to death. But the venom still has one more trick up its sleeve. It slows down the roach's metabolism to ensure that it will live long enough for the baby to hatch. When the little wasp hatches, it basically eats into the cockroach and feeds on it inside for up to a week until it fills the entire cavity. Eventually, the roach dies and the baby wasp spins a cocoon where it can finish developing its eyes, legs, and wings. When complete, it shakes off the roach, emerges fortified from the burrow, and leaves the carcass behind. This week I learned that reading books can help you live longer. A recent study looked at the reading patterns of more than 3,600 people who were older than 50. These folks were divided into three groups: those who read for 3.5 or more hours per week, those who read up to 3.5 hours per week, and those who didn't read at all. Researchers followed up with their subjects after a 12-year period, and after controlling for gender, race, and education, they found that readers had a distinct survival advantage. Book readers lived about 2 years longer than the non-book readers. Those who read the most were on the higher end of that spectrum, but researchers say that as little as 30 minutes a day can boost your longevity. And while reading newspapers and magazines had some benefits, reading books provided the greatest benefit. And that's likely because of the cognitive benefits of storytelling. Exposure to books improve vocabulary, reasoning, concentration, and critical thinking, thanks to the slow, immersive process of deep reading. You know how when you're drawn into a plot, you're swept up in the characters, you're forced to think about the larger story arc, you're making connections to other parts of the book or finding parallels in the real world, and all of that really gets your brain working. Books, particularly fiction, can also promote empathy, social perception, and emotional intelligence, which are all cognitive processes that can lead to greater survival. And finally, this week I learned the first American woman to win an Olympic event never knew she had accomplished such a milestone. Her name was Margaret Abbott, and she won the Women's Single Golf Championship in the 1900 Olympic Games, which took place in Paris. Now, the 1900 Games were only the second Olympics, and technically women weren't encouraged to play, but a small cohort of 22 women managed to make it into the competition, participating in 5 non-contact sports that were seen as appropriate for women: tennis, sailing, croquet, equestrianism, and golf. Now, the 1900 Olympics weren't like the modern games we know today. They actually stretched on for months and included events like tug of war, kite flying, and pigeon racing. And they were definitely a sideshow to the main event that was the 1900 World's Fair, which at the time was marveling attendees with such new inventions like talking films, escalators, Campbell's soup, and diesel engines. So yeah, the Olympic competition wasn't as popular, which might be one of the reasons why the first female Olympic gold went virtually unrecognized. In fact, researchers have found evidence that Margaret Abbott likely lived out her entire life never realizing she'd done it. In fact, Abbott's entree into Olympic Games is kind of vague and loose. She basically just showed up. She wasn't listed as an official member of the Olympic team, and it just so happened that she was in Paris at the time of the Olympics, and she heard there was a golf competition going on, so she basically entered and played. And actually, her mother entered and played as well, which is likely the first and last time a mother-daughter team competed in the same Olympic event. The Americans swept the women's golf tournament, taking first, second, and third. Margaret Abbott won a gilded porcelain bowl. Not for the glory of winning, but for the love of sport. And that does it for this week's episode of This Week I Learned. Look out for new episodes every Friday on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. To read more about any of the facts I've mentioned or to listen to the week's selection of podcasts, including 7-Minute Explainers and 7-Minute Opinions, go to theweek.com/audio. And if you like what you hear, subscribe, tell a friend, or give us a rating or review on iTunes. I'm Lauren Hansen, and thank you so much for listening.
I'm Josh Barrow.
And I'm Lynette Lopez. And this is Hard Pass, the podcast that definitely doesn't want to go to spin class with you.
Every Monday, Josh and Lynette will unpack, examine, and dismiss something you've been trying to ignore.
Aspen's full of rich people who are more or less screaming, "I'm rich, bitch."
All these little nerds on Wall Street want to be just like him.
The airlines are like flywheel. And as the airlines...
I just don't like this.
With each episode, you'll know more than you wanted, and that lunch at your desk will taste just a little bit better.
Find us wherever you get your podcasts or at Hard Pass Podcast on Twitter.